بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. إن الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. To proceed. Brothers, sisters, friends, there's no relatives. Respected scholars, academics, ulama, I greet you with the warmest Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. What that basically means in the English language is, may the peace and blessings of God be upon you all. I want you to give me an attentive ear. I want you to listen very carefully, because today's presentation or lecture is not going to be another dosage of intellectual, or for some of you, spiritual insulin. Because we all suffer from intellectual or spiritual diabetes. We live in the rat race, whether it's working outside or studying inside this university. The point is, we have become mechanical somewhat. We react to social biological conditioning, and sometimes, every now and then, we need a dosage of intellectual or spiritual insulin. I don't want today to be that. I want us to really positively engage, and for you to see this session as if we're having a cup of coffee, a cup of tea at Starbucks, or for the leftists amongst you, at Cafe Nero. Does that exist in Wales? It does, good. So the point is, I want you to treat today's conversation in that manner. I am not a formal academic. I am no one special. I'm from Hackney in London. I studied psychology, and I'm a student of Islamic philosophy and Islamic thought. I'm just a student. You're a student, so students are just talking to each other. I don't claim to be someone of an authority on this matter. It's just some of my ideas. And I want you to really take that on board, so you're just speaking to someone with ideas, and then you realize, well, I have ideas too, and I want to discuss them. I may agree with him, I may disagree with him, he may be right, he may be wrong. Many times I am wrong, just speak to my wife. So the point is, I want you to treat today's session in that way, so we could break the ice and really engage with one another. This is why I'm going to be using a pen today as well. The reason I was looking at it for a while is because I always make the mistake that we use the wrong pen for the wrong type of board or material. Because usually I use the one for paper, and then you can't rub it out after. But I think it's the right one. So, how can we start today's conversation? I want to start today's conversation with a profound statement from an American writer. A profound statement from an American writer, and it addresses every single one of you in this room. It actually addresses everybody on this planet. And the American writer once wrote, being born, your birth, my birth, our births, was like being kidnapped and then sold into slavery. Think about this. Your birth, my birth, our births, was like being kidnapped and then sold into slavery. And I totally agree. Every single one of you, if you're in prison, outside of prison, if you work, if you don't work, if you're poor, if you're a millionaire, if you live in the West or live in the East, regardless of that, you're a slave. And everything is illusory. Why am I saying this? Because I want you to think about something very carefully. You didn't even choose that you were going to be a man. Unless you have a lot of money, you could change that these days. But that's a different discussion. You never chose that you were going to be a man. Or that you were going to come from, where are you from?
Iraq.
Okay? You never chose that you were going to be a woman. You never chose your ethnicity. You never chose your DNA. You never chose your parents. You never chose your parents' character. You never chose the social biological conditioning of your parents. You never chose the social biological conditioning of their parents. You never chose your lineage. You never chose your context. You had absolutely no choice in these matters. And for many of you, you never chose your brother or your sister. You had absolutely no choice. None. Zero. Zilch. Worthy of an argument or discussion. You have had no choice in things that have defined who you are. Zero. So you're enslaved to that. I would even go further and say not only are you enslaved to your DNA and your social biological conditioning, I would argue that many of us are enslaved to our own selves. To our own selves, to our sense of self, to the carnal, bestial aspects of man, that we just react to the biological conditioning or the biological drives that many psychologists call instincts. Many of us are enslaved to those. This is why the famous 11th century theologian, Al-Ghazali, he wrote in his book, The Alchemy of Happiness, and he said something very profound. He said, you think you know yourself. You don't know who you are. You may know what you look like. You may know your shape and size. But you don't know who you are because when you're hungry, you just eat. When you're angry, you just fight. When you're enraged by the passions, you make love. You're no different from any other man, any other human being, and any other animal. You think you know yourself, but the true reality of yourself is in your inwardness. So he raised a profound point in the 11th century, saying that, look, are you just going to be a reaction to your conditioning? I want that because I like it. Because I want it, isn't it? Yeah? Are we going to be a reaction to our instincts? Well, think about that. So we can also be enslaved just to our instincts. Which is quite interesting because the Quran, which is the book of humanity according to the Muslims, revealed by the divine reality, this book says, have you not seen the one who takes his own nafs, his own ego, as his object of worship? So you're enslaved to your instincts, to your ego. Taking this further, we could say, well, maybe you're enslaved to social pressure. We are, many of us. I mean, look at the way you look. Especially this gorgeous guy. Yeah? MashaAllah, we have to say. Or even the way many of us look. The way we look is not a direct manifestation or expression of who we are. We are doing it because we are almost deluded by the fact that we feel happy when others are happy about the way we are and look. I remember working in an office when I was a project manager, and there was this PA, a personal assistant, and she'd be wearing these awful shoes. I mean, they're very high heels. Now, I'm not judging or anything, but very high heels. But the point that concerned me was she had plasters on her heels, like many of them. And you can even see sometimes blood, okay? It was like an awful sight. She had to use cream all the time, and when there was no one around, she'd take her shoes off and walk around on the barefooted carpet. And I'll say to her, listen, I mean, are you really comfortable in those shoes? Well, why did you buy them? It's like constant torture. It's like, oh, because it makes me feel better. It doesn't look like that. And I said, but why do you think it makes you feel better? And we just broke down the questioning, and this is the power of questioning. And she ended up saying, you know what? It's because other people think I look nice in it. That was it. It's that culture. L'Oreal, because I'm worth it. Yeah? But that's true. I mean, I know it sounds very crude, but all of our lives, regardless if we're religious or irreligious, we have that inside us because we're social animals, we want to conform. And this links to psychology, because if you read about social theory and psychology, there is a development of a social norm. And the development of a social norm happens because human beings want certainty. They want certainty, and there are two processes that occur in order to establish the social norm. It's called informational social influence and normative social influence. And they're both based upon our need for certainty. For example, if I'm uncertain about myself and my sense of self, and who am I, and why am I, and whose am I, and for whom am I, and for many of us on a Friday night, where am I? Yeah? For all those questions, you know, we are uncertain, so we go to society to get the answer. And that answer is only answered by influentials in society that have a say. Whether it's L'Oreal, media, the celebrity culture, the politicians, the priests even, the papacy, the priests with the white coats, scientists. Well, that's actually true, because many of you believe in things just because a scientist said so. That's no different from what the Pope says. I want you to think about that very carefully, because many of you can't even prove that the world is round. Actually, just for joke, prove the world is round. He's brave enough to do that. Is this Cardiff University? And everyone's silent and dumbfounded. Prove to me the world is round. Stand up. Speak, my friend.
I've got a picture of it.
Okay, good. Good. Okay. Let me ask you a question. The man has a picture of it. Okay. Now let me retort. How do you know that's the earth?
He Googled it.
But this is the point. You have to rely on someone else's say-so, which epistemologists, those who study knowledge and belief, they say that testimony, so the say-so of others is testimony. So he has to rely on the testimony of somebody else. It's just an image. What if I gave you a new image, a 2013 edition, and I said, actually, this is Earth. We got it wrong. And I printed a million of these pictures and got it signed by someone, scientist so-and-so. Would you then believe me? Exactly. Because you don't have any proof for yourself. It's all based on testimony. I want someone to give me proof. Come on.
Go fly around it.
But have you flown around it?
But you can.
You can, good. But is your belief based upon the possibility of you doing so? Because I know that you believe that the world is round now. Why? And you're going to find that most of it's just based on testimony. Because you're not brave enough, let me give you a story. I know you like stories. And by the way, we're not sidetracking. It's an important question to raise in your mind. I was having a discussion with this professional. He was academically orientated. And he said to me, I don't believe in your book, the Quran, because it says the world is flat. And we know for sure the world is not flat. Now, by the way, the Quran doesn't say that. But that was his view. I was in an arrogant mode, which you shouldn't be as a Muslim, but I just was really tired. I had a long day and the ego got the better of me. And I said to him, okay, yes, the world is flat. So what? I said, you prove to me the world is round. Prove it to me. Be a man. You guys are YouTube junkies, man. Be a man and show me that the world is round. I think it's flat. Yes, I agree with you. Do you tell me? And he was starting off, well, you know, we have pictures. Testimony. We have videos. Testimony. Well, scientists said so. Testimony. If I go on the mountain, I could see the curvature of the earth. No, all you could see is that. You can't see that. And he was going on and on and on. And I'm telling you, his face changed color. In all the colors. He was like a chameleon that day. And I was enjoying it. Because I thought, what arrogance. You can't even prove your presupposition that the world is round. It's all based upon testimony. I said, have you done the math? Are you a geologist? Do you know the mathematics? No. And you know what he said at the end, after almost half an hour of like sweating and being like, I don't believe what this guy is saying, yeah? Do you know what he said? He said, I could prove to you the world is round, because of the alternation of the night and day. And I recited a verse in the Quran that says, in the alternation of the night and day are for those who reflect. His mouth dropped. Beautiful day. The point of this, I'm trying to show you that a lot of things that we do just based on like this new priesthood, as the innovative scientist and biologist Professor Sheldrake, he wrote a book, The Science Delusion, he actually talks about this. It's like a new scientific priesthood. And we need to be careful as thinking human beings, because no one has a monopoly on thinking. Nobody. I don't care if his surname is Hawking, Dawking, Hitchens, Harris, Dennett, or whatever the case may be, even if he's the old Hume, Kant, Locke, regardless of those names. You have a mind. Don't enslave yourself. And that's why I'm talking about the new priesthood, because sometimes it can be the priesthood, because our reaction is what? Well, Dr. So-and-so said so. How is that any different from saying, because Allah said so? Think about that. Anyway, different discussion. I thought I'd bring it in just to get you thinking a bit more and maybe agitate some of the audience as well, yeah? But it's all good. It's all for us to think. So my point is, we can be enslaved to social conditioning because of this need of certainty. Okay? This need of certainty. And there's an interesting writer. Her name is Vivian Burr. She's a social constructionist. She wrote the book Social Constructionism, published by Routledge. And she said in a society, society changes its norms because of the constructs that are influential, such as the media, the scientists, the philosophers, the thinkers, these kind of, you know, influential structures. Could be teachers, parents, priesthood, whatever. They change society. And she used capitalism as an example. She said, in capitalist society, generally speaking, because it's based upon competition, you have personality traits on the spectrum of competitiveness rather than communitarianism. And that's why they did a study of values, and you could split the world in half almost. The West is more individualistic and the East is more communitarian. I know it's crude, but you get my point. And she also used language as an example. Even language is an influential factor, how we see language. Now take the word love. What does love mean, bro? Stand up, tell us what love is, if you don't mind. Yeah. Because you were slouching, I picked on you. What does love mean for you?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Happy.
That's so sweet, man. Say, brother?
I've never been in love.
You've never been in love? Wait, time out. You didn't hear what he said at the end. He said, I only love my mom. So what does love mean then?
Feelings.
Good, who said that?
Me.
Feelings. Feeling. Okay, good. Stay there. Don't move. Yeah? Feeling. Anybody else?
Emotion.
Anybody else?
Caring.
Where are you from? Where are you from?
Cardiff.
Get away. Ethnically, originally?
Caribbean.
See, that's profound. You see automatically the effect of social constructs. We have the Western individualists in a way, no offense, talking about an internal feeling. The sister, who's a rooted sister, what is she saying? It's an action. And in the West, generally, love has just become an internal feeling. That's why in domestic violence abuse, what would the husband say? But I love her really. Isn't it true? Look at these moron men's, huh? But 200 years ago, it was an action. This is why you have grandmothers saying, come here, son, let me love you for a bit. It's an action, a behavior. Even in Greece, my grandma would say, for instance, Ela edo na se agabiso ligaki. Come here so I can love you for a bit. So it's an action. So the way we see language changes our disposition. And it will change our feeling and the way we act towards things and react towards things. So the point here is that we're enslaved people to our social biological conditioning. We're enslaved to our egos and our carnal desires. And we're enslaved to our social and biological context concerning our parents and where we were brought up. So we're slaves. So you know this freedom that we talk about all the time and this liberty that we talk about all the time is actually we're just in a state of slavery. And all we're doing is we're changing our slavery. So the question I want to ask you is, how do you become free? It wasn't rhetorical. Yes, sister.
Break the chains of slavery.
Booyakasha. That's what I'm saying. Preach, sister, preach. That's exactly my point. Break the chains of slavery. And let me tell you something, how Islam, the Islamic tradition, tries to address this. And it's very important. Because I would argue, without Islam or enslaving yourself to the divine reality, you're always going to be a slave. Let me explain. The word ruh, ruh, means soul or consciousness or self in the Islamic spiritual tradition. Ruh. And it's linked etymologically, the root word is linked to raha. What does raha mean? Serenity, liberty has a whole range of meanings. So in a way, the ruh seeks this liberty. The soul seeks this liberty. Because it's shackled, as the sister said, to what? To your own ego and limited carnal desires. The limited nature of the self. It's enslaved to your context. Never chose your parents, family, social, biological situation. Enslaved to the social norm, because we're affected by the social construct and we need certainty, and the social norm influences us. So the ruh, the soul, wants to free itself from this. And the only way, as per the words of the 14th century theologian Ibn Qayyim, he said the only way to achieve this liberation for the soul is to be in a state of ubudiyyah, servanthood to the divine. Because once you are a servant to the divine or enslave yourself to the divine reality, you break the shackles, as the sister said, to the ephemeral nature of yourself, the limited nature of yourself, the social construct, the social norm, and all of these types of slaveries. So the way to free yourself from this is to change your slavery to the divine. And why does that free you? Because ontologically, which basically means the source and nature of the divine, is that He knows and you don't. He knows and you don't. Allah, God, by the way, Allah, linguistically, according to many Arabic linguists, means Al-Ilah, the deity. Okay? If you're a Christian and you read the Aramaic Bible, you'd be saying Allaha, which means the deity. So the deity, Allah, knows Hamza better than Hamza knows himself, ontologically. The source and nature of the reality, by definition. God knows you better than you know yourselves. So enslaving yourself to this reality transcends all of these limited types of slavery. Your own ego, your carnal desires, your social context, and the social norm. So if you truly want to be free, then what do you have to do? Establish a relationship with the divine reality. There's a lot of assumption in that, I know, which we're going to discuss. But the point is very critical. And let me give an example. Many of you may be non-Muslims in this room, and you see women covering their faces or their hair, which is a manifestation of the Islamic tradition. Now in Islam, well, for example, the Muslim sisters sometimes, what do they say on TV? I'm putting the hijab on because it's my free choice. Yeah, we jump into that liberal narrative and we actually give the wrong type of impression in Islam. Because if you were to wear a bikini or be topless and walking down Cardiff High Street, would that be your free choice as well according to Islam? No, because we're implying, the implicit assumption is that everything is allowed, and that's not true. Because The real narrative we should be talking about, which is very empowering, and non-Muslims would appreciate this, because we're being honest with our tradition. We're not using another tradition to justify our tradition. It's disingenuous. And you know, it's weak and cowardly in my opinion, okay? Well, I would advocate according to this perspective and say, actually, I'm a Muslim sister and I'm wearing the scarf. And this scarf is a liberation emancipation for me. Because I don't do things because of social pressure. I don't do things because it's because my dad said so, or my husband said so, or my brother said so, or L'Oreal said so, or Kim Kardashian said so. Yeah? I call her the pseudo-humanitarian. She's a fake humanitarian because she spends more money on shoes than she does on charity. That's a different issue. You get a lot of tax relief by giving charity as well. Don't forget that, yeah? I'm not judging her intentions, but come on. If you're really concerned about humanity, would you spend more on shoes? Come on. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, I am doing this because the one who created me commanded me. It's an amr, it's a command. And this liberates me because it frees me from the shackles of the social pressure, social conditioning, and my social biological context. And therefore I'm free. You're enslaved, although we call it the free world, but the irony of such language. And we see ironic language all the time, don't we? Like collateral damage, very cold, abstract, scientific term for killing innocent human beings. Or friendly fire. There's nothing friendly about friendly fire. You just killed your fellow soldier. Murdered him. Do you see? So these words, don't see too much in them. Look at the reality. So that would be a more empowering narrative, wouldn't you think? That would be much more empowering. So, how do we now free ourselves from these shackles? Because you know what? Studying it from an existential perspective, psychological perspective, you can't deny that truth. We are a product of all these things, and there is a sense of slavery there. We can't deny. This is what the existential philosophers like Heidegger and Kierkegaard, they developed a concept called thrownness. These are Western non-Muslim philosophers saying that humanity is thrown in reality and they had no choice. They're enslaved to that reality and context. And they argued the way to free yourself is by saying everything is meaningless. And when everything is meaningless, as Nietzsche, the famous scholar, they attribute nihilism to Nietzsche, but that's not very true. If we study Nietzsche properly, what did Nietzsche actually say? He said, he was very prophetic from that. He almost gave a prophecy. He said in 200 years, Europe is going to come to the situation where without God, you can't have objective meaning or objective morals. And then in that position, we're going to understand that everything is meaningless. And in that meaninglessness, we would have to become gods. We would have to become the divine reality, say these are our morals. And he appreciated though, when we become our own gods, then we're going to have conflict of values. And if that's the case, then values are relative. But if that's the case, then we have to battle them out. That's why he would say, the one with the power is going to win. But he was also asked, what do you do? And he said, well, I have my values, where are yours? So we define our own values, but they still become relative. But the point is, I don't even know why I'm making this point really. It's another one of my philosophical rants. Anyway, this is therapy for me by the way. I'm not really here for you, I'm here for me. It's true, it's all therapy. My doctor told me to speak to people. So, the point is, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we've created an interesting narrative, a backdrop, a psychological backdrop, and you know what, it does hurt. I know, I'm a Westerner, I'm Greek. Looks Pakistani, but I'm Greek. And, you know, my dad is, you know, extremely liberal, humanist, spiritualist. My mom is the same, brought up in the West, educated in the West. I still have a lot of Western values. I'm a Westerner. I'm from the West. So I do appreciate when I was thinking about these things, they affected me too. I was like, now, because we all have this ego, isn't it? That comes out and wants to protect us. Because what is the nature of the ego? It always wants to be right. Salaam alaikum, bro. It always wants to be right. It never wants to be wrong. It never wants to be dictated to or imposed. But it wants to dictate and impose on others. That's the nature of the nafs and the ego. Nafs meaning ego in the Islamic tradition. The ego is like that. So our ego is straight away going to fire out. This is why if you're reacting that way, don't worry, it's a process. It's like mourning, isn't it? First you're stunned. Then you cry, then you blame yourself, then you get over it. You know, that kind of cycle, yeah? And it's the same with the ego. I remember when one Muslim, before I turned Muslim, I converted 10 years ago, when he said to me that, you know, we don't do things for ourselves, we do things for the divine, I went to the toilet, I nearly felt sick. I did. I nearly literally felt sick. How can you not do things for yourself, but you're doing it for someone like a God? I felt sick. But I realized that was a disease. That's what the ego does. It wants to protect itself. It's illusory. Anyway, so I would argue the way to the way for the ruh, for the soul, to establish its liberty and freedom is to enslave yourself to the divine reality. But there are two assumptions in this, brothers and sisters. Two assumptions. Number one, that the divine reality exists. He's real. As we say in Islam, one of his names is Al-Haq, the truth, the reality. And number two, he has announced himself. How do you spell announced? Is it two N's? Yeah. Sorry. Announced himself to mankind. These are the two assumptions. Honestly. And if we could prove these, or show good reasons for these, or rationalize them, or show to the intellectual mind or someone who thinks that we have evidence for these, then surely what I've said is coherent and strong. Then for anyone who really seeks that liberty and freedom, would actually follow the route. So, does the divine reality exist? This is the easy question. Honestly, I don't know why people debate about this all the time. We have a new atheist movement. We have all these people fighting against the God and divine. And we have the Dawkins of the world. People writing books on this. People become millionaires on this question. But I am telling you, it is the most easiest answer. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. The divine reality exists. And we have 20 arguments. But I could just give you one simple one, okay? And I want to make it Quranic, meaning bringing it back to the Muslim scripture, because not because the ideas just belong to the Muslim scripture, because this idea predates the Quran, but to show that the Quran actually makes you think as well, that develops an argument. It's not for people who are just blind faith, believe because it says so. The Quran actually rejects that in totality. It says, are you going to follow your forefathers? Your forefathers. Even when what they were on was false and baseless. It's very existential from that perspective. Who are you? Just a reaction to your fathers, your forefathers, your DNA, your social upbringing? Question it. Think. أَفَلَا تَقِّنُونَ Do you not use your intellect, the Quran says? So, how can we show the divine reality exists? Well, in the Quran, in chapter 52, verses 35 to 36, gives us amazing logical possibilities for the explanation of the origins of the universe. Since the universe began, and I don't think we have to argue this, usually I actually spend 20 minutes on showing the universe actually started. But you know what? Once you know all the atheists are saying the universe started, then you know it started. Yeah? Even the Professor Lawrence Krauss, he's an atheist, physicist, cosmologist, theoretical physicist, award-winning, he wrote the book, Universe from Nothing, and he says T is equal to zero, that the universe actually began. And we have scientific and philosophical arguments to show the universe began. Let's have it as a healthy assumption. There's no point now proving the world is round again, do we? Apart from this brother here. So what are the logical possibilities for something that begins to exist? Because the origins of this verse was concerning the origins of the human being. How did the human being come about? How did the human being come about? And the verses have implicit and explicit logical possibilities. If you look at the exegesis, or in Arabic the mufassirun, those who explain the Quran, we have four possibilities. And remember these very carefully. Number one, that when things begin, such as the universe began, if it began, then there are four logical possibilities. It came from or via nothing. Number two, created itself. By the way, I know this is religious language, created. You could just change it to mean brought into being by itself. or originated by itself. So I don't want to like enslave you into my linguistic narrative, yeah? So you don't think I'm manipulating you, yeah? I've had that. You know, the reason I mention these all the time because you're just playing games with us, yeah? I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to make you think. Number three, it was created or brought into being by something else that was created. That was created. So it's bad handwriting. I do apologize. Number four, it was created by something uncreated. So let's just do this so I don't have to repeat. By something uncreated. These are the four logical possibilities. No one is going to deny this. If there's any more, let me know. I know there is one more, which is we don't know. But that is skeptical fundamentalism, I would argue. Because to say I don't know when we have four logical sound possibilities is almost saying I cannot trust the foundations of this building. Or the bridge that I just went across and paid the toll tax, £6 something, yeah? It's gone up, yeah? It was £5 the other month or something. You know, that bridge, for example, oh, I'm not going to cross the bridge because I don't trust the physics, yeah? I mean, that would be irrational. That's the type of skepticism we're talking about, yeah? And we could address this later. So could the universe come from nothing? Let's go. Who could answer this for me? Remember, this is not intellectual insulin. This is conversation. So now it's your turn. Could the universe come from nothing?
No.
Who said no?
Yeah.
Why?
It's got to be something like atoms or something. Just
or it can't, okay. It just can't. But why just it cannot?
You can't create nothing from something.
You cannot create nothing from something. You mean you can't create something from nothing? Yeah, that's fine. That's all right. So it's all that gel on his hair. It's a bit heavy. So the point is, right? Let me translate what he said in a mathematical way. What's 0 plus 0 plus 0? Is it 3? It's 0. Mathematically, to claim that something arises from nothing, and by the way, what we mean by nothing means the absence of that thing we're questioning. So there was no universe because it began. So in this nothingness, could the universe arise? And another way of looking at it, if the universe didn't exist, and now it exists, could that happen via nothing? You need an energy or process for something to happen. That's the point. I think this proves it mathematically. 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 is not going to be 3, ever. In any paradigm, in any reality, it's always going to be 0. And we know this intuitively, don't we? When we watch the magic shows, for example, and we see an empty box, and the magician, or the so-called magician, he closes the box and taps it 3 times and says, abracadabra, and then he pulls out a rabbit, you never ever believe intuitively, like, wow, that empty space just produced that rabbit. It's laughable, isn't it? Hocus pocus. You say, I'm impressed the way he tricked me. How did he do it? So mathematically doesn't make sense. Intuitively doesn't make sense. But again, I don't want to preach to the converted. There is a contention to this. Some atheists or physicists say, no, things do come from nothing. You have something called the quantum vacuum. And in this quantum vacuum, you have all these subatomic events that are appearing from nowhere. And therefore, something comes from nothing. Easiest way to dispel this myth is by saying the quantum vacuum is not equal to nothing. Because the quantum vacuum, go to Wikipedia now on your iPhone. Go type in quantum vacuum, 2 U's, okay? Type it. And it says the quantum vacuum is not nothing, it is something. It is a sea of fluctuating energy. It is a rich structure. It obeys the laws of the universe. So when they say the universe came from nothing, it's actually they're playing with words. We're saying the absence of the universe. They're saying, no, the quantum vacuum. Do you see? So that's not a healthy contention. So we know it couldn't come from nothing. Could it create itself? Why? Don't just give me an answer.
It would have had to have existed before it was created, and we know that it was created, so it doesn't make sense. It's incoherent.
Do you know that guy? Do you know him? No? Okay. You do? Okay, of course you know him. That's why he gave that answer. Good, well done, exactly. So the point is, if something created itself, it implies, as the brother just articulated, that it means that something was in existence and not in existence at the same time. Because to be self-created means that it wasn't there and then became there, but for it to be self-created, it was actually there before it wasn't there for it to be there. Confused? Exactly. Another way of looking at it is by thinking about your mother. Could your mother give birth to herself?
No.
Don't even think about that thought. I just saw someone's face do this. So don't think about it, yeah? Your mother couldn't give birth to herself. It's impossible. Could you give birth to yourself? Could you exist and not exist at the same time? Of course not. However, before we cross this out, there are two counter arguments. The first one is about biology. I had a debate with the head of the Humanist Association. His name is Andrew Compson. And unfortunately, it wasn't filmed because it was a very good debate. Alhamdulillah. And basically, he said, no, you're wrong. Things can self-create. We have asexual reproduction in biology. When you have a cell, single cell, it basically divides and then becomes two cells. Okay? There's a narrative there. Okay? It's not a very good picture. I do apologize. So he tried to use that as a contention. I started to laugh. Not against, because I didn't understand how he couldn't imagine that he didn't realize that his example supported my argument. Because first and foremost, the cell has to already be there. The universe once wasn't there. So it's a flawed example. The second point, how on earth does it replicate? What does it need? Energy from outside of itself in various forms in order to self-replicate. So if the universe created itself, if there is such a thing, it still needed energy outside of itself. Where did it come from? Aren't you just saying it's God? Power, another power? So he's assuming the universe was always there, which is not. This cell was always there before it replicated. And in order for replication to happen, you need energy from outside of itself. So it's not a good contention. Second contention, it's a little bit technical, but it's not a big deal. It's okay, we'll get there. It's by Stephen Hawking. And by the way, Stephen Hawking is a far greater mind than I am. I am not worth his toenail. Okay? No, I'm saying that because some people accuse me of being arrogant. I'm not. I'm not contending with his physics. I'm not a physicist. But I have a brain, and no one has a monopoly on thinking. So therefore, let's think about what he said. Is it true? So he wrote this book, A Grand Design. And in The Grand Design, which is the irony, he says on the introduction, philosophy is dead. Meaning thinking is dead. And his whole book is full of what? His philosophical assumptions concerning physics. It's still philosophy. So it's the irony. That's the point I'm trying to raise. You didn't get that? No? So he wrote the book The Grand Design. In The Grand Design, he's basically saying the universe can self-create because you have the quantum vacuum, okay? QV. Plus gravity, G. So quantum vacuum plus gravity and plus subatomic fluctuations. Okay? So listen to this. Quantum vacuum plus gravity plus subatomic fluctuations, you have the entire universe. Let me put this in layman language. A box, a magician, and a waving hand, and you have the universe. Doesn't it sound like hocus pocus? Honestly, this is just hocus pocus, but in scientific language. They're making you believe in magic, people. Quantum vacuum, the box, gravity, the magician, subatomic fluctuations, his waving hand, and you have a rabbit. Isn't the same as hocus pocus? I know it sounds funny, oh, you don't know the maths, and you're belittling physics, and you don't know nothing about quantum physics. Yeah, you're right. But we're still thinking about this, so let's keep on thinking. So he said this, And this is coherent mathematically, by the way, because in quantum physics, or in physics, you need the maths to be right, and then it has various manifestations in the real material world, okay? It has various manifestations. So, he's saying that the quantum vacuum pre-existed the rest of the universe, okay? There's no evidence for that. That's an assumption. And if it pre-existed the rest of the universe, he's saying the quantum vacuum is eternal. If the quantum vacuum is eternal, which is infinite, it means there has been an infinite number of quantum fluctuations. If there have been an infinite number of quantum fluctuations, it would mean that this universe must have collided with another universe by now, because all infinite possibilities should have been played out, because this quantum vacuum is in a state of infinite. Since we haven't collided with another universe, then his assumption is wrong. Do you know how some people argue away? They say, well, you know, the quantum vacuum is expanding. Okay, well, we're running the clock then. Then the quantum vacuum began. If that's the case, could it come from nothing? Couldn't it create itself? Do you see? So I'm dealing with this from a Taymiyyan perspective. Ibn Taymiyyah, amazing mind and philosopher of Islam, thinker of Islam, he went straight to the roots and assumptions. You don't even need to know the physics or the math. Just go straight to his assumption. Does it make sense? No, it doesn't. There you go. So, could it create itself? And we've dealt with the contentions. Next point. Could it be created by something else that was created, ultimately? Well, Dr. Jafar Idris, he's a philosopher of Islam, a theologian. He's unwell, so make prayers for him, please. Dr. Jafar Idris, he makes an amazing point. And he says, ultimately, if this universe was as a result of another universe, and that universe was as a result of another universe, and that universe was as a result of another universe, and that universe was, and it goes on forever, would you ever have this universe? Would you ever have it? Hello? Why? Q? Why? Well, let me give you an example. Say, for instance, I wanted to give this amazing handsome man a kiss on the forehead, right? And before I do that, he has to ask permission from the guy next to him. If that went on forever, would I be able to kiss him on the forehead? Another example. Say, for example, I want to shake his hand. I want to shake this brother's hand. But before I shake his hand, I have to ask permission. If he says, well, I can't give you permission until the guy next to me asks permission. If that goes on forever, I'm never going to shake his hand. Good. Let me give you another example, just for it to sink in. Say I'm an American Marine, and I want to shoot a bird. If only they shot birds, huh? I want to shoot a bird, right? And in order for him to shoot the bird, he has to ask permission from the Marine behind him. If that goes on forever, is he ever going to shoot the bird? No. Another example. Say you have a row of dominoes, you can't see the end, it goes beyond the horizon, but all the dominoes you see have fallen. What does it mean about the end of the domino chain? Does it go on forever, or did it have a beginning? It had a beginning because they've fallen. Exactly. Another example for it to sink into your head. Imagine you're walking into this room. I just walked into this room and all I hear is Hamza, 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 an echo. Am I going to assume that echo was just going on there infinitely long, forever? It was always there? No, there must have been someone outside of that reality to say Hamza, to initiate. So this is why we're saying you can't have an infinite regress of creative dependencies, if you like. That our universe was as a result of something else that was created, which could be another universe, and that universe was as a result of another universe. If that went on forever, you would never have this universe. This is why Ibn Taymiyyah said, you would have non-existence. So, look what we've concluded. That this universe was created by something? Uncreated, exactly. But it doesn't mean it's God. It doesn't mean it's Allah. It doesn't mean any of these things. It doesn't mean it's all the 6,000 names or 4,000 names that we've disagreed about since 6,000 BC Sumeria. Study the history of God and you see that we have around 3,800 plus names for God. God knows. However, in order for us to conclude the Islamic monotheistic version of God, we keep this thinking process. We keep on using our brains and using our minds, Sometimes we call this conceptual analysis. That's just a big word for saying, think, dude. Yeah? That's all it is, so don't worry. So if we keep on thinking that there is an uncreated creator, then it must be eternal. Because it's uncreated. Number two, it must be powerful. Why must it be powerful? Well, let me ask you a question. Split an atom, what happens? Split an atom. Sorry? No, it doesn't. When you split an atom, I mean, you've been incinerated. It's a nuclear bomb, yeah? Isn't it, essentially? So that atom has so much potential energy, right? How many atoms are there in the universe? A hell of a lot. So the point is, if this uncreated creator created the universe and one atom has all that energy, it must be powerful. Take the sun, for example. The solar flare of a sun is equivalent to 100 or 1,000 Hiroshima nuclear bombs. So we can't conclude it's powerful. Number three, must be knowing or intelligent. Why am I saying this? No, because what's in the universe? If I drop this pen, what happens? Why does it drop? Gravity, right? What's gravity? It's a law. So a lawgiver implies an intelligence, right? It is very simple. Very simple. Number four. Must be transcendent. Sorry, I can't spell. Must be transcendent. What do I mean by that? That the creator, the uncreated creator, must be distinct and disjoined from creation. Look at this lectern, everybody. Those sisters who are talking, look at this lectern. Yeah? If I made this lectern, do I become the lectern? No, I am distinct and disjoined from this lectern. This is why Ibn Taymiyyah, the classical theologian, he said that the creator must be transcendent from his creation. Number five, must have a will. In Islamic thought, this is called an irada. Must have a will. Why must it have a will? This is very simple. If this uncreated creator is eternal and it brought into existence the universe that began, it can only mean one thing. That it chose the universe to come into existence, and choice indicates a will, and a will indicates it can have a relationship with conscious beings. Finally, number six, it must be one. There are many, many arguments for the oneness of God. But one key argument I like to use is Occam's razor. Occam's razor. Now, forget the term, it's irrelevant. Think about the principle. What is the principle? Now, the principle is misunderstood because people think it means don't multiply entities beyond necessity. Don't add more entities that are unnecessary. It creates problems. It doesn't mean that. Occam's razor actually means it means that the simplest explanation and the most comprehensive explanation is the best explanation. So, there are a few components. Simple explanation and most comprehensive. Because sometimes it doesn't have to be simple because it must be comprehensive. They have to be both together. It's not or, it's and. So, the simplest and most comprehensive, okay? Now, what does comprehensive mean? Subpoint. It means it has greater explanatory scope, so it explains most things. Number two, it has greater explanatory power. It has more rational force. That is Occam's razor for you. And this is a way to understand scientific conclusions or to understand conclusions about certain theories or to understand answers to certain questions, whether they're more powerful rationally or not. It's a unique way of looking at things. So, God being one, all powerful, eternal, and transcendent, and knowing, is number one, simple, because it's just one. Is it comprehensive in scope? Yes, because it answers the origin of the universe, answers the laws about the universe, answers about all these different things. Okay? What about if we said God must be two or three? Is it simple? No. Does it have explanatory scope? Does it answer most questions? No. Because there are new questions now. How on earth can you have two, three, or four all-powerful beings coexisting? And you can't answer that question, so it loses the comprehensive nature of the explanation. This is why Islam says very humbly that the belief in more than one God is irrational. And Occam's razor shows why. It's polytheism is not simple, and it's not a comprehensive answer. It doesn't answer all the questions. It actually creates far more questions than it solves. So look what we've done. Just by using our brains, we've come to the conclusion that Allah exists. Why? Because Allah is an eternal, powerful, knowing, transcendent being that has a will and is one. The Quran says this, the book of the Muslims, book of humanity, 1400 years ago, in the 112th chapter, قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَدْ اللَّهُ الصَّمَدْ لَمْ يَلِدْ وَلَمْ يُولَدْ وَلَمْ يَكُلْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدْ. Say, God is one. He is eternal. He is self-subsisting. He begets not, nor is he begotten. There is nothing like unto him. And the word Allah, قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ, say God, say Allah is one. Allah implies, linguistically, a powerful, knowing, and transcendent being with a will. So the whole chapter implies what we've just concluded. Some atheists say, well, this is God of the gaps. Have you heard this before? It's quite an outdated cliche. Is you don't know nothing about the universe, you don't have a scientific answer, you don't know the answer, you just squeeze God in there as an explanation. Sorry, I'm not going to let you get away with that. 2 points. God of the gaps, the door of the God of the gaps, swings both ways. Yeah? For the scientists or the atheists, it's the same thing. They say, we don't know, but science will answer it. Go check out Richard Dawkins' book on page 157, 158, The God Delusion. What does he say? We don't have an explanation for the universe like we have for biology, evolution, but we're going to wait and hope for one. Doesn't that sound God of the gaps? Science of the gaps to me? It's the same kind of situation. But also the argument is misapplied because it's not God of the gaps. Why isn't it God of the gaps? Because we've concluded via rational processes. There's a universe, it began. If it began, there's four possible explanations. If there are four possible explanations, therefore it must be X, Y, and Z. Oh, this is quite in line with who God is in Islam. Do you see the point? We haven't said, we don't know, therefore God exists. Do you see? So it's a misapplied contention. So this is dealing with the first assumption of what I spoke about in the beginning, that the divine reality is actually true. What is the second assumption? The second assumption is about the Quran itself. So in the last 10 minutes, I believe we could articulate a very positive case for the Quran. What is that? Theories of inflation. So we have to rub the board. So you know, many people will argue, okay, this is fair enough. How do we know what you're saying is true? How do we know Islam is the way forward? Because Islam says that your purpose in life is to... Thanks, bro. Your purpose in life is to worship God. That's what the Quran says. Your purpose in life is to worship God, to free yourself from the shackles of these things that we spoke about earlier, and to enslave yourself to the divine. You feel free, you feel liberated, and you get paradise, and you don't deserve punishment anymore. That's the very simple reality. Exactly, that's what I need, bro. Thanks. So, sorry. So basically, how do we prove these things? Well, we've proven the divine reality, or we've given good reasons to believe in the divine reality. Now, what about the Quran? The Quran. Now, according to Eastern and Western scholarship, the Quran has been described, and think about this for a 7th century book. The Quran has been described as a very intrusive text. It wants to impose itself on everybody. Yes, Sharia is coming. I'm only kidding. You know, imposing? Anyway. I drove 3 hours, guys. You look dead more than I do. What's going on? Am I boring? Ah, thanks, darling. So the point is, guys, you know, I deliberately make these jokes sometimes. It's neuro-linguistic programming, because you would associate, because people don't remember what people said. That's why we have the video. They remember. They remember on how you made them feel. Do you know that? That, you know what, he was such a good guy. Oh, so what did he say? Well, I don't know, but he was such a nice guy. You have that all the time. I have brothers coming out of the auditorium. Oh, Akhi, brother, that was a wicked talk. You smacked it, you murked it. Yeah? Whatever, you murked it, man. What a gua, you know what I'm saying? Yeah? I'm from Hackney, so that's how we used to speak, yeah? You murked it. I was like, oh, bro, what did I do? Do you remember what I said? No, man, it was just great, man. It was just great. You, what did I say? Oh, man, man, you're my Akhi, man. Like, what? What is this? So they just remember how you made them feel, yeah? Not what you actually said. And this is why I said in the beginning, in a very serious way, that this should be just a seed that plants in your mind so you could do your own reading and thinking. That's what we need to do, guys. Okay? No more priesthood, okay? That's not the Islamic tradition. We don't believe in priesthood. We respect the ulama, the scholars, the inheritors of the prophets, of course. But generally, every human being, the Quran, God tells you to think. وَفِي أَنفُسِكُمْ أَفَلَا تُبْصِرُونَ And in themselves do they not see. أَوَلَمْ يَتَفَكَّرُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ Do they not reflect within themselves. وَكَذَلِكَ نُفَصِلُ الْآيَاتِ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ And thus do explain our signs and evidences for those who reflect. يَتَفَكَّرُونَ Coming from the Arabic word فَكَرَى Which if you go to the classical dictionaries, you know what it means? It means don't be just a desert romantic and pretend you're thinking, writing poetry to your loved one, sitting on the deck chair, looking at the stars and playing with the sand and drinking a pint of milk just to make it halal. Yeah? Don't be like that. And that's so true because that's a disgraceful way of thinking. Whereas the Quranic approach is, the thing you're thinking about, inquire about its implication. Inquire about its implication. What does it mean that there's a beginning to the universe? What does it mean that I have intentionality? How can I have a consciousness if I'm just material? Because consciousness can't come from non-conscious matter. How do we explain this phenomenon? These kind of questions. Think. Don't just superficially reflect. And the Quran has been sent down to make you think. And that's why I was saying earlier that Eastern and Western scholars have said that it wants to impose itself on you. But this imposition is positive because it wants to engage with you positively. It's almost crying out for you to think. I'm telling you, if you read some of the classical scholar works, when they describe the nature of the Quran, they say it's like a hand that goes straight into your soul and gives a good shake. And for others, a good bashing. Because some people are asleep. Wake up. There's an accountability. Woke up. Life is not a game. فَأَيْنَ تَذْحَبُونَ And where are you going? We always look at other people. She's got this, I don't like her dreadlocks, or she's wearing this, and I don't like her shoes, and oh, he's got better Xbox than me, or whatever, blah, blah, blah. He said this about me, that about me, and Christ says, shut it. Where are you going? فَأَيْنَ تَذْحَبُونَ Where are you going? And the Quran specifically deals with the ego as well in a profound way. How does it deal with the ego? You think you're almighty now. You forgot your origins, you forget where you're going. So bring yourself down because people only appreciate truth when the ego is broken. You see this with academics. Sincere academics say, I don't know anything. They treat their students not as students. They won't even call them students. They'll call them colleagues. We have this with our ulama, with our classical scholars. Like Sheikh Isa Ni'matullah, he's a sheikh in his own right, in hadith, in prophetic traditions. And he's never called his students once. And his scholar, who's a greater scholar than him obviously, never called him a student. Because they knew, I'm nothing. The more I know, is the more I realize that I know nothing. And the Quran really beats this ego down in two ways. What does it say? كُلُّ نَفْسٍ ذَائِكَةَ الْمَوْتِ Remember, you're going to die. You're going to become one buffet. You think you're going to be here forever. Wallahi, some people think they're going to live forever. I am telling you, I know in my family of 80-year-olds that have so much money in the bank, and they live in poverty, not only emotionally, but physically. And they're thinking they're living forever. And I've told them, we don't want your money, but buy yourself a house. Go abroad, go back to your own home country. Live under the sun. Don't die in this cold. Take care of yourself. You have enough money for your final years. Where do you think you're going with this? And they talk to me as if I'm 80 and they're 8. It's delusion. It is ego delusion. And remembering and really contemplating about death, it just shocks you. You know what? I'm going to be worm buffet. I'm not going to be here. I mean, this whole room just in a relative short period of time, is going to be filled with other people. You're going to have gray hairs, or you're not going to be here. Reflect on that. And also, if that doesn't work, the Quran says, okay, where were your origins? You were a baby, you couldn't even lift your own neck up. Try holding a baby. Try holding a baby. Leave it on its own. Go on, you're free. Every man was born free. Say that to a 1 month old. Let the parents run away, let it deal with itself. Go on. Ridiculous, isn't it? You couldn't even hold your whole nip. You couldn't even wipe your backside. Honestly. I change nappies as well. Now and then. But the point is, change nappies and you see the children are so vulnerable. They just can't do anything. And you were like that. And now you think you could take over God. Like Professor Lawrence Krauss. The arrogance. I really respect him as an academic, but come on. We call a spade a spade. He said, I'm not an atheist, I'm an anti-theist. Do you know what that means? In the words of Christopher Hitchens, it means, even if God did exist, I would reject him. Come on, man. I mean, how far do you want to go? I mean, how far do you want to go? It's like the arrogance of the statement. But you could even wipe your own backside. Your own mother had to teach you A, B, and C. Go even a bit more further. You were a despised fluid. Yeah? Nutfatin min maniyin. You were a nutfa from the mani, from the semen. You were a despised fluid. You were nothing. Exactly. Bro, if that's the noise you make, we've got issues. That's the point. Well, you were a dribble. You were a dribble of fluid. That's it. That is absolutely it. Let's get serious, guys, eh? But you know what? These things are important for the ego. And we have to, even the Quran says, forget that, forget your birth and where you're from and your death. Remember others. Look at the people who had even more power than you did. Where are they now? Where are they? They're finished. The dust crumbled. Go to Greece. Go to Athens and you see the statues and the columns and Parthenon and the Acropolis. Go to those places. Where are they now? Where are they? Where? So the Quran wants to engage your thinking and really put our egos back in its place so it facilitates the search for truth. So the Quran makes you think. It makes you reflect upon reality. أَفَلَا يَنْظُرُونَ إِلَى الْإِبِلِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَتْ. Have you not seen the camel and how it was created? Reflecting within yourself, man, life, and the universe. It's full of these rhetorical questions to make you think. Because when you read the Quran critically, all of the verses concerning man, life, and the universe are teleological. What does that mean? They are there for a specific end. What is that end? That end is to acknowledge the divine reality, His oneness, and acknowledge that He deserves to be worshipped, not you, not others, but Him. So they're there to facilitate that thinking process. But you know what? The Quran goes even further than this. The Quran even challenges the whole of mankind concerning His authorship. In the second chapter, Surah Baqarah, verse 23, the Quran says, وَإِنْ كُنْتُمْ فِي رَيْبِ مِمَّنْ نَزَلْنَا عَلَىٰ عَبْدِنَا فَأْتُوا بِسُرَةٍ مِنْ مِثْلِهِ وَدُعُوا شُهَدَاءَكُمْ مِنْ دُونِ اللَّهِ إِنْ كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. And if you're in doubt, talking to the doubters, atheists, agnostics, humanists, people on the fence, people sitting on the fence, people in the fence, yeah, everybody, yeah? Scholars, thinkers, laymen alike. This book we have sent down to our servant Muhammad, upon whom be peace, sallallahu alayhi wasallam. Bring a single chapter like it. Call on your witnesses and your supporters besides God, in kuntum sadiqeen, if you're truthful in your claim. Now we know this opens a whole array of what we would call as Muslims miracles of the Quran. However, I just want to focus on one. It is the literary miracle. Why did Professor Bruce Lawrence from Duke University in his book, The Quran, a Biography, on page number 8, he said, Quranic verses are expressive of an inexhaustible truth. They signify meaning, layered within meaning, light upon light, miracle after miracle. Why did Professor Martin Zamit from the Netherlands say, Notwithstanding pre-Islamic poetry, the Quran is the most eminent written manifestation of the Arabic language. Why did Reverend R. Bosworth Smith in his book Muhammad and Muhammadanism say, the Quran is a miracle of purity of style, of wisdom and of truth. It is one miracle claimed by Muhammad upon whom be peace, and a miracle indeed it is. Why did Professor Hamilton Gibb say that the Quran challenged mankind and no one was able to challenge it and produce anything like it? Why did Professor Arbuthnot, the British Orientalist and translator of the Quran, or Arabic translator, he said, although several attempts have been made to challenge the Quran, none have yet succeeded. It can't come from man. Why did Professor Neil Robinson, in his book, Discovering the Quran, A Contemporary Approach to Veiled Texts, talk about a whole chapter of the Quran, concerning the Quran called the dynamic style of the Quran, saying the Quran has an amazing dynamic style that surpasses all Arabic literature? Why did, for example, Professor Anthony Jones from Australia talk about the imaginistic features in chapter 12 of the Quran? We could go on and on. Honestly. Why did they say this? For money? For fame? No. I think it was the epistemic duty. It was the duty to truth. Now you may think, I'm not an Arab. You're damn right. You're not an Arab. Many of you are not Arabs. So how can we appreciate that this is a miracle? I could go to the technicalities, okay? I could say that the Arabic language has many literary forms. We have Saja'a, okay? We have Mursal. We have poetry, which has 16 rhythmical patterns called the Al-Bihar. And these Al-Bihar are syllabic-based rhythmical patterns. Then we have Saja'a, which has a pattern as well, but it's based on the accent, based on the stress of sound. We could talk all about this. We could talk about how Shakespeare is not a miracle just because he's amazing, because this has nothing to do with the amazingness of the language, it's about the structural features. Because Shakespeare was reproduced by Christopher Marlowe. His works is based on the iambic pentameter, the blank verse, and the trochaic verse that's used by other English literators. We're talking about the Quran is neither of these forms of the Arabic language. It de-scopes the Arabic language. No one has produced anything like it, and no one will ever will. Although people have challenged the Quran to achieve this. So not only is the Quran unique, but it's inimitable. It cannot be reproduced. Even though it came down to the 7th century Arab who was socialized to a position who could express himself best in the Arabic tongue. This is why the Arab historian Ibn Rashik, what does he say? He said the Arabs used to celebrate on two things. When a boy was born and when a poet rose amongst them. So if these people fail to challenge the Quran, and we know this from the traditions and the historical statements of Walid ibn al-Mughira, he was the most famous linguist poet of the time, and he said, by Allah, swearing by God, this can't come from a human being. I'm the best at prose and poetry and the linguistic devices. Khalas, this is beyond us. So, if that's true, that the best place people to challenge the Quran failed, then we could prove it's a miracle, and you don't need to recognize Alif, Ba, Ta. You don't have to recognize any letters of the Arabic language. I'm telling you. You don't have to recognize any letters of the Arabic language. If all you have to do is use your brain. And the process I'm going to be talking about is called logical or rational deduction. Logical or rational deduction. What is logical or rational deduction? Last 5 minutes and you see. It is taking a universally accepted statement and then drawing logical conclusions. Taking a universally accepted statement and drawing logical conclusions. Now, the universally accepted statement concerning the Quran is no one has been able to challenge the Quran effectively. So, if that's the case, we don't need to know Arabic and we could still prove it's a miracle. Let me go back to the early stages of this talk. Of this conversation. Do you remember what I was talking about the world? Whether it's flat or round? And the majority of our beliefs was based on testimony? Yeah? It's a valid source of knowledge. We have multiple testimonies by authorities, Western and Eastern, that no one has challenged the Quran effectively. So what I'm going to show you today, if you in this room reject the Quran, it is equivalent of rejecting that the world is round. Because they're both based on testimony. I would even go further. Rejecting the Quran today will be equivalent of rejecting that your mother gave birth to you. If anybody's a man, stand up and prove to me your mother gave birth to you. Do it! Prove it! Prove it!
Just ask my mom.
Sorry? Sorry, sir?
Just ask my mom.
Yeah, exactly, but it's her testimony. Where's your proof, sir?
I was too young.
You were too young, exactly. Anyone got proof?
DNA.
DNA? Who said that? Stand up. Do you believe that your mother gave birth to you now?
Yes.
Yes, you do. Good. Do you have a DNA certificate at home? So that's not proof for you then. Because you believe in her now. Why? Is it because you've done a DNA test?
No.
You get a slap. Mom, I believe in you now. I've done a DNA test. Tapa, yeah? You get a good slap, right? So why do you believe in her now?
He had a DNA test.
He didn't.
Pictures as I was growing up.
Oh, did you hear that? He's got pictures. And some people claim that they got videos of them coming out of the womb. Do you know how I replied? I said to them, you can sit down, bro, yeah? You know what I said to them? I said, that's interesting. Did you come out the way you look now? So how on earth could you recognize yourself? Oh, they told me that was me. Oh, testimony. They still have to tell you that was you. So frankly, guys, we have four testimonials that your mother gave birth to you. Number one, her testimony. Number two, your father's. Number three, the midwife. Number four, the doctor. Four testimonies. We have far more concerning the Quran has never been challenged before. So you reject the Quran, it's like rejecting your own mother gave birth to you. Interesting, huh? Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Right. So, if that is a universally accepted statement that no one has been able to challenge the Quran, we have some possibilities. Either came from an Arab, a non-Arab, you're late for tomorrow's lecture. So an Arab, a non-Arab, Muhammad, upon whom be peace, or God. So there's four possibilities. So we've discussed the universally accepted statement. So there are four possibilities. Well, number one, could it come from an Arab? I would argue can't come from an Arab because the best Arabs at the time that came from a homogeneous society, meaning that there wasn't much linguistic borrowing. Now we live in a heterogeneous society that with linguistic borrowed terms and language has been diluted and degenerated. Go to Egypt, ask for the phone. Telephone? Yeah? Or watch the TV? The television? Go to some villages in Iraq, ask for chocolate. You know what they say? Nestle. Was it Nestle, yeah? From the company Nestle. So you see, linguistic borrowing is degenerating the language. But the classical tradition was preserved, and the Arabs who were best placed to challenge the Quran absolutely failed. Hence we spoke about Walid ibn al-Mughira. So it can't be an Arab, it can't be today's Arab for the reason we just mentioned. Could it be a non-Arab? Well, the Quran even says this is impossible because this book is Arabiyun Mubin. It is pure Arabic. So you have to know Arabic. So it can't be from a non-Arab. This is very easy. What about Muhammad upon whom be peace? Maybe he was a genius Arab. Well, this is false on many accounts. Number one, he was an Arab too. And if he could produce something, then so could they. Number two, they didn't accuse him of being the author, the best people who understood the language. Number three, he wasn't known to go to the Ukaz fair when they were debating prose and poetry. He was not known to have poetic cultivation. Number four, if it is human expression, they say it's from Muhammad upon him be peace, he was human. If it's from a human expression, All human expression that exists today in a form of a blueprint can always be replicated. Always. You could see replications of... what's that famous artist's name? Picasso. Monet. Impressionism, post-impressionism. You have expensive replicas. You know what canvas they use, the texture, the paints, the brush strokes, the type of material. It's the blueprints there so you can replicate it. All human expression is like that, even with Shakespeare. But we have the eternal challenge, which is the Quran. It exists today. It's with us and it's alive, and we have the blueprint where the words are, the letters, everything. But we can't exhaust. We can't replicate it, even though we exhaust 28 finite letters and grammatical rules and finite words. We exhaust all possibilities. We can never produce the Quran. Also, the literary character of the Quran is in the divine voice. If you study psycholinguistics like I did in university, we did a module in psychology, you know that when you read Shakespeare, some of Shakespeare's characters in Shakespeare. When you read Homer's Iliad, you know some of Homer is in his Iliad. Psycholinguistic analysis. You know the voice represents his life or his emotional being. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam suffered a 23-year prophetic career to the point where he tied two stones to his stomach. He was so hungry. He saw his companions pass away and be tortured. He was stoned by children in a town in Arabia. But yet none of this emotive character is in the Quran. It remains in the divine voice. And there's so many other reasons, but this suffice. So therefore it must be from the divine. So in the question, is life is just a game? No, it's not. What is life about? Is to remove yourself, as we said in the beginning, from the slavery of yourself, from the slavery of your context, from the slavery of others, by enslaving yourself to the divine. And how do we know this is true? We've proven the divine to exist, or we've shown good reasons to believe the divine exists, and we've shown good reasons to believe that the Quran is from the divine. And if the Quran says that you're here just to worship the divine, which means to know, to love, to obey, and to worship God, then that's your purpose. It's not a game. And we're going to end up in two places: paradise or divine alienation. The nar, the fire. And the decision is yours. You could walk out this room rejecting this, but it's equivalent, in my humble opinion, of rejecting the world is round and rejecting that your mother actually gave birth to you. But also, because it's not just about intellectual gymnastics, think about the values of Islam. Tolerance. Justice. The Quran says, "Inna Allah yuhibbul muqsitin." 3 times in the Quran. God loves the just. Compassion. In the Quran, in the 91st chapter, the Quran says, what is the steep path? And what should tell you what the steep path is to free a neck, to free a slave, to feed the destitute, the poor, or the poor relative, or the orphan, and to be one of those who call to steadfastness and compassion. We're anti-oppression. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said in a prophetic tradition, "Itaqu dhulma fa inna dhulma dhulumatun yawm al-qiyamah." Be conscious of injustice and oppression. It's going to be darkness on the day of judgment. We love for others what we love for ourselves. لا يؤمن أحدكم حتى يحب لأخيه ما يحب لنفسه. You won't truly believe unless you love for your others, love for your brother what you love for yourself. Quran talks about charity. Giving charity. We talk about peace. It was Islam under the Islamic values that we preserve the Jews. The Jewish tradition when they were being persecuted. Because of these principles of citizenship and tolerance amongst minorities. Think about what a Jewish rabbi said in 1453 in a letter in his book called Constantinople. The rabbi says, "Oh my brethren, come to the land of the Turks, the Muslims. Rich are the fruits of the earth. We live in peace and freedom. And we're not oppressed with heavy taxes." Similarly, a 19th century Jewish historian, Heinrich Gratz, what did he say? He said, The Jews live favorably under the Mohammedans. It's because of our principles of justice, tolerance, peace, accountability. What about economic distributive justice? Study the economy of Islam. It's going to save the world, believe me. There's going to be a civil war in Greece soon. I'm telling you, because of the disease of capitalism. A false geopolitical model that says too many needs, not enough resources. It's a false lie. Why are 10 million people dying in America of obesity and millions dying of starvation? According to the UNDP report, millions of children die every year just because there is no food, apparently. But according to the Food Agriculture Organization, there's enough calories in this planet to feed three planets. The issues of distribution and the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, in the Quran, solved the problem of distribution. And it's based on a proper, accurate geopolitical model. Because the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said in a prophetic tradition that could be found in the collection of Tirmidhi, he said the son of Adam just needs food, shelter and clothing. Define the essential limited needs, creates a philosophy of distribution, not excessive competition. And there's many more things to say about Islamic economy. It's a phenomenal reality. This is why Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, one of the caliphs of Islam, he said, "Oh people, put wheat on the top of the mountains, so the people don't say that we kept the birds hungry." His concern was birds, because everyone had food, shelter and clothing. Just go to Turkey yourself, you see the Ottoman mosques. Two big domes in the middle, full of gold. The historians say they were always full of gold, although the poor could go and take some gold for the day. Never in a state ever have we had everyone having food, shelter and clothing. Never. In this country, we have 90,000 homeless families. In America, 25 are living underneath the poverty ladder. I was in Chicago a few months ago. Children only go to school to have the only meal. Islam solved that problem. Investigate it. Today's your window of opportunity. May God bless you. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta wa astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum.